Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, if you believe Dr. Edward Castronova, there is a hurricane coming that will cause one of the great social cataclysms of the 21st century. That hurricane, he believes, is virtual reality. Now, you've heard the phrase, you would have heard of a couple of computer games or video games that utilize virtual reality. But after we've spoken to Dr. Castronova, I think you're going to realize that this is much bigger than the occasional computer game. Dr. Castronova is a former professor of economics who's turned his studies to the impact of virtual reality computer games. In fact, there's about 30 million plus people playing these games already, spending hours immersed in computer-based fantasy worlds. The doctor says it'll cause drastic changes to our society, including, listen to this, a mass exodus of people who like the virtual world better than the real one. Dr. Edward Castronova, welcome to Open House. Good to talk to you.
Thanks very much for the intro. Very nice.
It's certainly an interesting concept, this mass exodus of people heading off to the virtual world. Firstly, for those who aren't quite as initiated into the whole virtual reality idea, tell us what they are. Virtual reality games, avatars, virtual worlds. Give us some examples. Some people would have heard of Second Life, but that's certainly not the only virtual reality game out there.
You know, most people don't play video games a lot, and what they see is maybe their nephew or something playing a game, and it's colorful, and you might see a character and some guns and some dragons or something. What folks need to get in touch with is, you know, you can imagine looking at that screen, and suddenly there are some characters running around in there that are being run by other people, okay? So it's not just some dragon being run by the game, but there's someone else on a computer anywhere in the world who's logged in, and now they can sort of collaborate with your nephew, or your nephew and that person can fight. And so now we've got real human beings interacting in a way that human beings do, but in a completely virtual environment. And these numbers like 10 million, 20 million, 30 million people doing this, that's where it starts to acquire some sociological significance.
And it's not just for 14-year-old boys, too. Like you were saying, you know, we initially think that it's just a teenage kind of phenomenon, but you're in your 40s, you've got a wife, two kids, you're an enthusiast. In fact, there's lots of people from all the age groups that are actually jumping on board.
Right. You know, people who play this one world called Second Life, you know, they're about half female, half male. And you might ask yourself, why would somebody in their 40s with little kids and a wife, why would they do this? Why would they spend time there? And just looking at myself, I say, well, the attraction to me is I'm like everybody else. I want to be a hero sometimes. And that's a pretty broad human desire. It crosses cultures and male, female. Everybody wants to kind of be the star for a while. And that's why this technology is both exciting and perhaps dangerous.
You've made some pretty big predictions about how the phenomenon will actually change the world. In fact, you suggest it'll change it more than any other form of entertainment. Give us your top three predictions.
Well, you know, most people in science are not supposed to speculate, but, you know, I think about people in global warming community, they're making predictions all the time, too. And so that's why I feel a little liberated to do this. So my prediction number one is that fertility is going to fall. Because people, you know, they're real people and they can interact in the computers and satisfy one another's urge to have sexual encounters that way. There's a technology emerging of sort of remote stimulation and so on. So I would guess within a few generations, it's going to become like you're going to have a conscious decision to get out of the virtual reality and go make a baby. You know, I have concerns about fertility. Mm-hmm. The second one is a huge part of our economic life is probably going to exist within these environments. People are already starting to examine how forms of corporate organization are going to change as we get new generations who, you know, they want instant feedback. They want to have an exciting job that involves their own heroism. You know, and if they have the choice of, you know, working for virtual gold or working for real money, they'll work for the virtual gold, and so corporations, schools are going to have to change forms of organization. And the third area, I would say, the third prediction is that public policy is going to have to change. Because the people who design these virtual places are acting like governments. They're setting up entire socioeconomic political systems. And if they can make a world that is more fun to live in, how is the real-world government going to react? What is the real-world government going to have to do to get people to come back out of virtual reality and stick around in the real world for a while? So those are the three main changes that I see.
This is Open House right across the nation, the openhouse.net.au for the podcast of our chat with Dr. Edward Castronova, the author of Exodus to the Virtual World. He's basically spent the last few years researching the virtual world. He's not just a gamer himself. He's actually a former professor of economics who's thinking this thing through and thinking where it could go. You suggest there could be a mass exodus of people who like the virtual world better than the real one. We've talked about 30 million people already involved in games, but that can actually be up to 100 million participants at the moment, couldn't it be?
Yeah, it's growing exponentially. So just since I wrote the book, the number that people use is 50 million. So you write a book a couple of years ago, people say 30 million people in virtual world, and now everyone's saying 50.
Yes. So how popular could it become then? Where do you think the trend is pointing to in terms of numbers?
It's going up, and then you have to ask yourself, what would stop it? If you think about what technology is going to be able to do as computers get more and more powerful, it won't be too long, and almost any fantasy world that a person could want to live in will be created. Places people want to be, from outer space to deep sea to King Arthur to, you know, romances of the early 19th century to Gothic horror. I mean, you name it, everybody's got something that they're into.
Mm.
And the game industry is making billions of dollars satisfying. Reality is cool. It has some wonderful things about it. But what motivates people isn't reality itself. It's satisfaction, happiness, joy. And so we really have to ask ourselves some tough questions. How joyful is the real social system that we've made? For some people, it's great. For lots of people, it's not horrible, but it's dull.
The question mark is, though, of course, we still have to eat. And so we right. might be stuck to our computers and playing these virtual games and everybody kind of running off to their fantasy worlds. At the same time, you've still got to pay the bills. And I guess that raises the whole idea that there is actually a virtual currency out there. But can you earn a living from it? Can we see this mass exodus of people running off to the virtual reality world, earning a living from it?
You'd be surprised how much of the economy is already devoted towards things that don't involve survival. You go buy an expensive coat to protect yourself from the cold. How much of that money went to the sheer technology of protecting you against the cold, and how much was spent on because of the way it looks and its cut and its color and things like that? Same thing for your car and your house. A huge fraction of the economy is already spent on things that don't involve survival. And if you just stop and say, how much money would I need each month just to have nutrition go into my body, not freeze to death? It's not going to be a huge part of most people's budget in the developed world. So can there be a virtual economy where a person could produce enough sort of valuable services in that economy to cover that sort of minimal level of taking care of the body? The answer is yes. You know, there are already people who live in China who farm gold in virtual worlds. What they do is they just go into the virtual world and they don't play it. They just sort of kill the monster over and over again and get the gold pieces.
Right.
They sell the gold pieces to rich people in Australia and in America, and they live on a dollar a day.
And when you say gold pieces, these are virtual gold pieces, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's something where you kill a dragon and you get treasure. Well, they just kill the dragon over and over again, get the treasure, and then sell the gold pieces to rich people.
Huh.
And they live on that, a dollar a day.
Boy, okay, so some people are already sustaining their existence based on the virtual world.
Right.
That's quite fascinating.
And so, if you think about a future where let's say I'm an educated Westerner, and what's most important to me is what happens to me in my virtual world, well, then most of the services I'm going to buy are virtual world services.
Mm.
You know, in Second Life, you know, I might want a different hairdo. How do I get a better hairdo? Well, I got to get somebody in this virtual world Second Life to make a hairdo for me. And I might pay $100 for a real dollars for it.
Yeah, and yet my own hair, my real hair, will actually still keep on growing as well. I'll still have to get that cut sometime.
Yeah, or if you're me, you don't have to. Which is why I might want to be in the virtual world, because I have a nice head of hair again. You know?
This is Open House. We're talking to Dr. Edward Castronova about virtual reality. I've got to say, some of this is really quite concerning to me. I can see all the fun and I can see all those kinds of... But, you know, there's a lot of question marks that, you know, start to raise in my mind very, very quickly, whether it be the fact that so many people could exodus to this virtual world because they don't find the current world fun enough, satisfying enough. as joyful enough as it could be. What do you see are the other major problems with the whole virtual reality world and a number of people flocking towards it to escape this life?
Well, I mean, my sense of a good life doesn't really involve sitting in a pod and having some experiences piped into my brain. I don't think that's a good life. You know, if we refer to the notion of the dignity of the human person, that's not a very dignified life. So that's why I'm concerned about the technology. As much as I like the idea that it might liberate people and allow them to have more meaning in their lives, at the same time, you know, the human body is important and physical connection is important. So I think we face with this technology the same sort of questions we would ask of television, of the telephone, of the automobile. You know, how do we integrate the good parts of the technology without overdoing it and having the bad parts? So, you know, the tough questions are the questions I face with my six-year-old. How much virtual reality do I let him have in a day? When do I turn the screen off and say, you have to go outside and see the sunshine? My concern about this technology is just that it's going to be more attractive than television ever was. And so what sort of social institutions and norms are we going to develop to not sort of demonize the technology, but integrate it in a healthy way?
Just speaking of Second Life, which is, you know, one of the better-known virtual reality games, recently we had news of the first, I guess, virtual reality-induced divorce, where one woman caught her husband's avatar having an affair with another avatar on a virtual couch, and so she actually divorced him in the real world. So obviously, yes, virtual and real worlds are starting to merge, and so what happens in the virtual is actually affecting the real world. When it comes to virtual reality, when it comes to, say, something like Second Life, are there any moral codes there at all?
I don't think the moral codes that are there are any different from the real world's moral codes. In other words, I think what we need to do is establish effective real-world moral codes, and they will help us go into the Internet and into virtual reality and know how to act. So that example of the Second Life-induced divorce, I don't see that any different from any other pornographic sort of activity. So if my wife, you know, if I found her spending all of her time on the Internet looking at you know, interesting pictures, and she wasn't interested in me anymore, that would be something I would go to counseling about, you know? And so the mere fact that it's virtual reality with another person adds another element to it. But the essence of the problem isn't the virtual reality. It's in the nature of intimacy in the couple.
I think you're right. I think it very much does come back to the fact that you can jump into a virtual reality world. At the same time, you're actually taking you, the real person, the real Edward, the real Sheridan, into that world in terms of, I guess, a spirituality, in terms of a heart. You know, the evil you can commit in a virtual reality world has really already started happening in your own heart anyway, where it comes to, you know.
And you can hurt people in a virtual world just as you can in the real world. I mean, one of the first feelings that people have when they go into a virtual reality environment is they think all the rules are off. And so they do mean things to one another. I have students who do this, and they laugh about it. And I say, like, they'll find somebody who's clearly, like, 12 years old, and they'll sort of make fun of him. And I say to them, do you go down to the mall and find 12-year-olds and kind of pick on them? No, you don't do that. Why would you do that in virtual reality? So we still have to behave.
Yes. Another thing that comes to my mind is the word anhedonia. It's something that Dr. Arch Hart talked to us about, this this kind of overloading of the pleasure center in the brain with, and he suggested that it's any kind of pleasure that's produced by a computer chip is the problem. And he said, you know, that kind of pleasure is problematic because it actually overloads our brain with pleasure to the point where we cannot get pleasure out of the small things of life.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that. I like that. I mean, the term that I use is fun. I have a pretty technical definition of fun, but the key thing in fun to me is that it's short run. You know, the pursuit of fun can, just like the professor said, block out our interest in the small things in life and also long-run satisfaction. You know, if you do nothing but play a video game all day and all night, what are you going to be doing when you're 65 and everybody else has got their kids hanging out with them and their grandkids, and you played a video game your whole life?
Yes, yes.
So I think, again, we have to keep thinking about what's good for the human family, what adds to our dignity rather than taken away.
Do we already have counseling centers set up in Second Life or these other virtual worlds?
Not in, but we do have lots of counseling about. So there's a government-sponsored program in Korea, for example, to deal with game addiction. And there are people in the United States who've done that. I don't know about Australia, but there will be more and more counseling about these matters.
And the other question, I think, comes to my mind, and was the whole idea that you mentioned at the beginning, is this kind of a virtual world gives us the opportunity to be the hero for a little while. And again, that kind of raises questions to me about our sense of identity, a sense of who we are, a sense of a certain sense of contentment. I think of Mark Brown, a guy who we spoke to a little while ago, who's actually building a church in Second Life. And he made this very interesting comment. He said, you know, I really, really believe that people need to get their first life straight before they go into their second life.
I like the idea of a church in Second Life, because that is an outreach that's going to be needed. There will be people who are lost out there.
Yes.
We have to tell them, come back into reality.
Yes. Well, Mark was actually saying that it was opening up some really interesting theological discussion in terms of what actually is sin in a virtual world. And I think it comes back to our original conversation. Again, it's our own hearts that are actually causing us to act a particular way in the second life world, world.
Though I'd like to make a point in defense of virtual reality and the way it's developing on these matters. The modern secularist environment doesn't do very well with good and evil and right and wrong. It's very uncomfortable with those terms. And so I understand why that would drive people into virtual reality, where as part of this heroism, it is clear what's good and what's bad. And you are told, encouraged, rewarded as a person to do the good thing.
Okay, you just clarify that. How does that work, though? Just because of the hero aspect? Or because you were mentioning before that some of your own students are still picking on people that they otherwise wouldn't pick on.
Right. So, here's how it happens. The game designers say, there is an evil dragon doing evil things. Let's all, and you'll get gold pieces and a magic sword if you go kill the dragon. And so that, I like that.
Mm.
Okay, that clearly identifies good and evil, and people go off. But what I don't like is that then my students will get into a group with other human beings to go fight the dragon, and they'll trick the 12-year-old into attacking it first.
Mm.
That's where I could point to my students and say, you're not learning the lesson, you're acting like the dragon.
yes, that's very interesting what you've just said. So it's actually maybe helping us to rediscover a sense of objective right and wrong. At the same time, from the perspective of Christian theology, there's still a fallen human being that's actually playing these games, and so we can turn it around and use it for our own good and actually still take sin into there.
You know, the first part of it was introduced by Tolkien. You know, the entire Lord of the Rings, as I understand it, was his effort to sort of say, the modern world has thrown right and wrong out the window, so here's a new mythology. We'll just start from scratch, and let's make it quite clear that there are, you know, good entities and bad entities in the universe, and my heroes, you know, fight for the good. This has sort of maintained itself throughout the entire video game industry. You have dark heroes, there's no question about it, but nobody writes something where a video game where people just get rewarded for doing nasty things.
Fascinating to talk to you, Dr. Edward Castronova. Appreciate your time.
No, thanks very much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Dr. Edward Castronova there, a former professor of economics, now turning his time to the impact of virtual reality computer games on the world. Fascinating stuff, isn't it? The author of Exodus to the Virtual World, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast, if you think you know somebody who needs to hear the chat.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.